All right, let us return to our hero. We have a special guest today, too. Is that okay? Alex and Becca, geniuses extraordinaire, and at large, in general, who honor me dearly with their presence. I'm humbled beyond belief. I'm never humbled, either. Rarely. Come on in, everybody. I know it's spring. So you hear me? No one comes to my class, either. Look at this place. This should be a full room. No respect. All right, so let's get into this thing, because this is an exceedingly complex turn in this text, and I'm at once going to indulge a fair amount of its complexity, and some of it I'm just going to let go, right? Because it just speaks to things that just exceed our time and our scope, that hopefully you begin to see what's at stake. So you can imagine these cats sitting there. They just had this. You can remember they're sitting by the grass there. Socrates just gave this very long, very involved, totally surreal, thoroughly pornographic speech, right? Just this demented, but it is kind of exquisite and quite engaging in a lot of ways, right? I mean, you can picture, remember, this is not just his giving of ideas, but it's actually an event in the text. Something just happened here, an interaction between these two people, right? And with us, right? So we're privy to their interaction. So their interaction is itself our interaction, if that makes some sense. Right? Their rhetorical event becomes our rhetorical event. So this thing finally ends, and it's long. You know it's long. And Phaedra says, yeah, okay, I join in your prayer, Socrates, and pray that this may come to pass if it is best for us. All this while I've been filled with admiration for your speech. You made it so much more beautiful than the one before. Why does that matter? Phaedra is this weird kind of moron, isn't he? Okay? I mean, he sort of missed the whole boat. He's like, oh yeah, that was pretty. When it's this kind of, again, this ambivalent moment, because it is a more beautiful speech, but Socrates keeps telling us that what's at stake is not its beauty per se, but that it speaks of the good, right? That it praises God. So it's not that it's beautiful, but that it praises beauty that matters, right? So presumably what matters is the constative component, but what Phaedrus has just complimented him on is the performative component. It would seem to kind of be at odds, but again, it's an ambivalent moment, because Socrates does enjoy this performative moment. Right? He does like language to be beautiful, not just to be of the beautiful. Right? And then he says, I'm afraid Lysias may cut a poor figure if he still wants to enter another speech. As a matter of fact, he was just made fun of for being a speechwriter, and I think he may stop. And Socrates is like, you're nuts. That has nothing to do with it at all. And Phaedra says, well, it seems so. You know that the most influential and dignified people in political life are ashamed to write speeches or leave behind them any prose writing through fear of being called sophists by posterity. This is the first time we've seen this word, sophists, right? He's naming us. We are sophists, right? So this should be of interest to us, right? And Socrates is like, yeah, I don't think these people are so bummed about leaving their speeches, right? About writing, about having their names forever inscribed in parchment, right? At the very end, he says, then if this speech remains on the books, it is in a joyful frame of mind that its author leaves the scene. Its author leaves the scene. That is precisely what we've been talking about all semester, right? That writing inaugurates this death of the author, this leaving the scene, right? That the minute you write something, you per se are divorced from the thing you wrote. It is in the very nature of writing that you leave the scene. Okay? And in many ways, a lot of the debates around rhetoric and around writing focus on the status of this leaving the scene. Does this make some sense? Right? And we've talked about this quite a bit, right? That the author, that's what it is to write, right? That it's the separation between you and your writing, right? We've talked about it. It's like hairs, like nails, it's like shit. It's like these things that are part of you and not part of you kind of at the same time. You produce this writing, but then, you know, I'm going to hand you today, you know, your writing assignment for your final. And it's going to be a weird moment for you, because you're going to have to create this thing. Our whole picture on the board here, you're going to have to birth this thing. It's going to come out of you, and then you're going to hand it over. Right? But you're nowhere to be found. John and Vincent, thank the Lord, it's not me, are going to be sitting there grading your papers, but you're nowhere to be found. They're talking about your writing, but you're nowhere to be found. Isn't that weird? They're judging you in your absence. You're nowhere to be found. You've left the scene. question is, what status does that have? Why do we care? What happens now that you've left the scene? That what Socrates will imply is that this leaving of the scene is a kind of abandonment, right? And he will actually make it akin to childbirth, right? It's a parenting, right? That it's a kind of abandonment of your child. And that what you actually spawn when you write is what he calls a bastard, an illegitimate son, right? And that somehow maybe when you speak, you don't leave the scene. Because when you speak, your words and your body are one and the same. Does that make some sense? Right? That is presumably the argument he's making, that when you speak, you're self-present to yourself. Your words are right there. Right? So if you say something, somebody can counter, you know, what you said to you. You are there to defend them. You are father of your own words. But, right, what's freaking weird is that Socrates is constantly leaving the scene, even when he's speaking. How? In a variety of ways. Right? One, he hears voices. He covers his head. Right? He's inspired. Things are coming from without him constantly. Right? So maybe he is present, but he's not. He's both present to the scene and not present to the scene. Something else has taken his place. There's been this strange kind of substitutions. The Muses take his place. Phaedrus takes his place. He quotes Pindar in the beginning. Right? This series of other voices speak through him, in a way making him, having him sort of take leave of the scene. And then, of course, is the fact that we're reading this. Right, and this is the first beginning of a hint of irony, that the only way we have Socrates here is precisely because it's written down. The only way we know what he said is because it's written down. Right, so this is the beginning of a kind of ironic moment. All right, so the author leaves the scene, and he's pumped. So Socrates says, you know, on the top of 44, he says, it's obvious then that these attitudes arise not from the disparagement of the practice of writing, but from the high value set upon it. So while Socrates poo-poos writing, there are these people called sophists who love writing. They want their name, they want to spawn as many bastard children as possible, in a sense, right? They're seducers of language. They're seducers of the audience. They just persuade without respect for truth, without respect for love. You begin to see here how the seducer, right, the non-lover, becomes akin to the sophist. Right? Just as a sophist who wants to just persuade a crowd simply to get his way, not for truth, but simply to get his way, is really, to Socrates, no different than somebody who seduces a guy who seduces another little boy, not because he loves him, but because he digs his booty. Right? It's the same thing. Right? It's the seduction. Right? Does that make sense? Right? How this turn in the dialogue to begin talking about rhetoric and speech making is really the same as everything they've been talking about up to here about lovers and non-lovers. Right? What is it when you speak? Do you speak to the truth? Do you speak for the good? Do you speak for the best of everything, to honor the divinity? Or do you speak just to get your material way? Just as when you're in the domain of sex, do you go just for the sex, or do you go for the sex with the love? That's how Socrates is mapping these things onto each other. Right? You with me? So they're talking about this, and about halfway down, Socrates says, well, it'll be quite obvious to anyone. There is nothing in itself disgraceful about writing speeches. Well, Phaedrus says, well, why should there be? But the disgrace comes in when the speaking and the writing is not good, when it is, in fact, disgracefully bad. It's, again, this very strange, ambivalent moment. First of all, we all know that by the end of this dialogue, Socrates says there is something inherently wrong with writing. Inherently wrong with writing. Here he says there isn't anything inherently wrong with it. Right? To write, to give speeches is fine. It depends what you say. At the end of it, he says, no, I don't care what you say. I don't care what you say. Writing is always bad. Okay? So at some point, he's giving a position, and he's going to reverse his position. Okay? Again, he's going to function a little like the rhetorician. Gives a position, argues kind of both sides. That's what he's constantly doing. He argues one side, he argues another side. You watch what he's doing performatively. Here he's making a claim, he's going to reverse his claims. He's never set in his ways. The only way he's set in his ways is by not being set in his ways. So he becomes this weird kind of despot in a weird way. It will become the tyranny of irony. Yeah?
Just to add what you're saying, from the bottom of page 31, he does mention the sophist.
Is that right? Oh, yeah.
Says,
all right. Yes, we talked about this, yeah.
And a tyrant.
Yes.
So did you get this?
Oh, yeah, Vincent. Look at you guys. Vincent did it on Tuesday. That exact point.
Oh, okay. We think alike.
Yeah, that was weird. That was like a weird deja vu. You're right. I skipped over there, and Vincent called it out. Right. Do you want to speak to it more? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Just like what you were saying, that Socrates himself performs the role of his office.
Right.
But he already said earlier that his office is a tyrant or a demagogue.
Right. Right. And he put himself at the top. Philosopher's number one. Philosopher's always number one. But again, yeah, he plays the rhetorician. He plays the basis thing. And he does function a little like a demagogue. It's funny that he puts sophistry and demagoguery together, right? And it's obviously related because a demagogue is somebody who manipulates the people, a little bit different than a tyrant per se, right? Who just rules with an iron thumb. But the demagogue kind of works the people over to his favor, right? I have to be honest, I'm accused of demagoguery sometimes, right? I have been my whole life. So he says, so they're talking about, is writing inherently good or bad? They say, no. Why would writing be inherently bad? Why would that make any sense? It's only when you say bad things. That seems fair, right? Okay. So Socrates says, what then is the way to distinguish good writing from bad? On this subject, Phaedrus, do we need to question Lysias or any other author? This is again strange. Past or future of political or non-political writings in verse or in prose? Phaedrus is like, what do you mean? We need to. Of course we do. What's already weird here? What has Socrates asked for to reach an answer? Right? He beckons, yeah.
Ask for people who would generally think that writing is a good thing.
All right. But what is it? What's the weird thing here? Right? I mean, he's asked for texts. Right? The very thing, it's a strange, again, this kind of seance that's gonna keep recurring. He constantly brings forward the written word. Right? He has this kind of ambivalent feeling towards it. So here he's kind of trying to make sense of the, you know, sort of making sense, but poo-pooing, really questioning the written word. He says, well, you know, the author takes leave. But here he is beckoning the authors. Let's bring them present. Let's make the author who's absent present through his written word. Another just peculiarly ambivalent moment, but how he stands towards what he's saying. We're about to get to a strange, beautiful moment. And Socrates says, we have, I think, plenty of time. And all the while, the crickets above us in the heat are chirping and conversing with each other and seem to be looking down at us. If they should perceive that we too, like most people, were refraining from conversation at midday, relaxing our minds and nodding our heads under the charm of their spell, they would do well to laugh at us, taking us for a couple of slaves who had come here to rest, sleepy sheep drowsing through noonday by the fountain. But if they see us conversing and sailing up past them, unbeguiled by their siren voices, perhaps in admiration, they may give us what the gods have granted them to bestow on mortals. This is a weird freaking moment, okay? And we'll get to the myth of the cicadas in a minute. So they're talking, and all of a sudden, he's talking about crickets. He's talking about the sound again. He's talking about the place. And he says, his claim here is quite odd, right? He says, if these crickets were just, if we were just sort of like succumbing to their beauty, crickets make these beautiful songs, and we just were like, isn't that nice? They wouldn't respect us. But precisely because we're ignoring them, they might respect us and out of admiration bestow gifts upon us. Right? It's a very strange moment here. Right? Because precisely what seems to be at stake in here is how what we say pays homage to the good, to the gods. What is the best way to speak the truth, to speak the divine? That's what Socrates is asking. How do you speak the truth? How do you speak divinity? Here he's saying, we're in the presence of gods. These crickets are muses. Right? What is the best way to honor them through language? To ignore them and keep on talking. Right? So we got to figure out why. So let's keep reading. Phaedrus says, what is this gift? I don't believe I've heard of it. It is most certainly improper for a follower of the muses not to heard of such things. Once upon a time, before the muses were born, these crickets were men. And when the muses came along and song made its appearance, some of the men were so overcome by the pleasure of it that they sang and sang, forgetful of food and drink, without even noticing even the approach of death. And from them, the race of crickets subsequently came into being and received from the muses the gift of needing no nourishment, the prerogative of singing on and on without food or drink from the moment of birth until they die. Then they proceed to the goddesses to tell them which mortals here on earth specially honor each muse. They tell Terpsichore this, Calliope that. And to the eldest Calliope and to the next Urania, they make report of those who live a life of philosophy and honor the art of these muses, who above all the others sing the most sweetly in their preoccupation with heavenly things and with discourse mortal and divine. This is really freaking weird to me. And I'll tell you, I wrote a very long paper on this exact passage, man, because this is the whole argument to me. Couldn't be more succinctly put, right? So there they are, they're talking, right? And the best way to honor these gods, right, is to engage in discourse, both mortal and divine. That is the best definition of irony we're going to get. The definition of irony is right there. It is discourse, both mortal and divine. Right? Because irony speaks, I'll help you out there, because we've talked about this before, right? The irony speaks simultaneously in the mortal world, and then it faces its own mortality and points the divinity into truth. To me, a succinct, pithy definition of irony, and it might seem surprising, is a discourse, both mortal and divine. Right? That we think about irony as this kind of, as either a joke or humor, or as somehow postmodern and ironic, you know, postmodern and nihilistic and negative, but that's sarcasm, that's nihilism, that's not irony. Right? Have you ever seen, and my examples are so dated, it's embarrassing, Wayne's World? Is this a movie you guys saw? You have seen? Wayne's World, really, Mike Myers in general, really just is operating a different world. I don't kind of dig him, only because I saw him in 54 and he was hilarious. But there's a moment in the film where he's talking about sponsorship, right? I saw this movie so long ago. He's like, you know, they want to come and sponsor us, but there's no way we'd ever, you know, stoop to saying we drink this soda, and he's actually drinking the soda. Right? Is that irony? He actually is doing it. It's actually nihilism. It's actually a free fall into nihilism, right? He's telling you that he's selling out to the man, and he's doing it right in front of you, and he's like, yeah, here it is. He doesn't actually efface the thing, right? There's actually no irony there. The way he stands towards his character is just never ironic. On the contrary, it's thoroughly indulgent. It's thoroughly nihilistic. Right. That's also how you stand towards the pleasure, right? Because there's an odd moment here where you don't want to give in to the pleasure of the crickets, right? But in a way, you're not turning a deaf ear to them either. They are noticing them, right? So it's almost like the use of pleasure, if I may be blasphemous in a sense here, right? That it's almost like putting pleasure to use, right? Infusing pleasure, right? Yeah.
I'm still confused as to why.
Please. No. Good, yes. It is a form of nihilism in the Nietzschean sense, right? But it's also deeply religious, right? So to Nietzsche, religion is nihilistic, because any belief in God is nihilistic, right? But then there's sort of a post-deistic nihilism, which is, in the sort of parlance of our times, nihilism is generally considered sort of post-religious, a belief in God. If you believe in God, you can't be a nihilist, according to contemporary culture, right? They claim people who are materialists are the nihilists. Nietzsche is the one who reverses that. Right, so you're fair enough. There's two kinds of nihilism. There's Nietzsche's, and then there's, you know, the rest of us. Right, so do you all understand that? Socrates, to Nietzsche, is a nihilist because he points to the divinity as opposed to just purely indulging this life. Nietzsche's a man thoroughly of this life, even if he's born posthumously. And what's even stranger about how you stand towards these muses is that you sing sweetly. You sing sweetly as you talk. Right? So now it does matter how you speak. Right? Language here does matter. You want to pay homage to them by ignoring them, speaking beautifully of things both mortal and divine. It's such a peculiarly kind of, talk about an ambivalent moment. Right? But I love this notion of a discourse mortal and divine. Right? And now we begin to understand why Socrates doesn't leave the city. Why the fact that he's outside the city here matters. Right? Why does he, if he has this great disdain, in a way, for this mortal coil, for the civic, for the human, why does he stay talking to people? If he really privileges the divine, why doesn't he become an ascetic? Why doesn't he remove himself, go live up in the hills, you know, not speak to anyone, take a vow of silence, eat nothing but a little mush and water all day? Why doesn't he? If he truly wants to get closer to the divine, further away from his bodies, why not go the ascetic path? Live like the Dalai Lama, who's the least ascetic person I know. Absolutely, right? Our bodies are the medium. Our bodies are here. We are mortal. We are mortal. Right? And to be mortal means to be both physical, sensual, temporal, historical, and eternal, divine, invisible. It's to be both things simultaneously. That is the challenge that this text throws down to life, is this challenge of this of Socratic philosophy. How do you live if this is the case? If you are both divine and mortal, how do you live? What do you do? And his answer is, there is only one answer. It is irony. You live the ironic life. You don't just speak ironically, you live ironically. Right? It means you live simultaneously through this life and through the mortal life. I mean, the immortal life. You live simultaneously in and of this body, which is why Socrates is constantly so profane, so physical, so sensual. Why he's telling, he has money shots in the middle of his speeches. Right? He digs it. You don't say no to these things. He's not chaste. Right? He indulges. He likes boys. He likes booze. He likes food. We see him doing it all the time. Here he is with Phaedrus, flirting his head off. Right? He has lovers. He doesn't, he'll claim his disdain for the body, but at the same time, he understands you need to live through the body. It's the challenge he throws down to us. The fact that we are composite. And once we are composite, once we are this amalgamation of incommensurate things, mortal and divine, eternal and historical, how do you live? And then, rather specifically, how do you speak? That's what's going on here. How do you speak? What is the relationship between words and truth? So again, notice this dialogue will have a lot of seeming asides, such as this random conversation all of a sudden about the crickets. But I'll tell you, there's no such thing as a random aside in this dialogue. Right? Everything here is a symptom. Everything here performs the text in some way. Right? So what I just gave you, I hope, is a good mode of approaching rhetorical analysis. You find the moment that maybe everybody skips over, and you say, no, that's everything. That's the key to this text. Right? So you take this random aside here about the myth of the cicadas, and you say, no, this is what he's talking about the whole time. Right? It's a good rhetorical trick when you're writing papers. Good, isn't it? How are we doing? Everybody okay? All right, let us proceed then. I love little moron Phaedrus. You flip the page. Well then, let's talk. But the fact that Phaedrus is a moron matters, is of note to us, right? And it's what I've suggested to you, and we will talk about it in some detail probably on Tuesday, if not the end of today, that Phaedrus is not the student in this dialogue. He's a moron, right? It's obvious he's a moron. He has nothing to offer, really, right? What Phaedrus will do is he'll go through this very simple path of reversal. He'll begin as a sophist and as a philosopher. So he says. But he always just has one position. He's always univocal, Phaedrus. He's always one. Socrates is always two. He's always dialogic. That's why he privileges the dialogue, the two logics. Phaedrus only ever speaks in one voice at a time. It's why he's so frustrated constantly with Socrates. Are you joking? Are you serious? I don't get it, Socrates. You got to tell me. He can't embrace multiplicity. But we as readers are the students who are in many ways taught how to recognize, appreciate, and hopefully speak multiply, speak ironically. We are taught the ironic life, a life that Socrates does not teach Phaedrus. Phaedrus is a bozo. Phaedrus learns nothing. Phaedrus goes through a faux transition. whether he's a sophist at the beginning or he's a philosopher at the end, both times he thinks he knows. And for Socrates, that's the mistake, thinking you know. Right? Because the only thing you know is that you don't know. Right? So there's a false narrative in here. Right? Or an instructive narrative. But it's not that we follow it. It's that it's there for us not to follow. If that makes sense. Okay. So here they go. Poor moron Phaedrus. So they're going to try to figure out how to distinguish good writing from bad. And Phaedrus says, well, you know, I heard you got to know what's true. Right? I've heard it said that it's not necessary, for the man who plans to be in order to learn what is really just and true, but only what seems so to the crowd who will pass judgment. In the same way, he may neglect what is really good or beautiful and concentrate on what will seem so. For it is from what seems to be true that persuasion comes, not from the real truth. This is the critique of rhetoric. I mean, this is the classic critique of rhetoric. This is the critique of rhetoric and sophistry in that book I keep talking about on bullshit, right? That you don't actually have to know the truth, you just have to be able to manipulate the crowd. That's the critique of rhetoric, right? That we're shameless, immoral seducers. Yeah. But what they don't learn, what they don't understand is that we are amoral, brazen, lover seducers, right? We do it all, baby, right? It's what makes us the grooviest cats on campus, okay? So how much to get into this thing? So we're gonna talk all about this crap. And I don't know how much to point out every pun in here. But let's keep going. Jump to page 47. It says, Phaedrus says at the bottom, Socrates, we need these arguments. We gotta know what everybody's saying here. If we're really gonna talk about this, let's bring the arguments forward about the status of writing. He says, bring the witnesses here, and let's find out what they have to say and how they'll say it. Right? And come here then, noble brood, and convince the fair Phaedrus that if he doesn't give enough attention to philosophy, he will never become a competent speaker on any subject. Now let Phaedrus answer. It's such a strange moment here. Because again, he just performed this kind of seance. He just beckoned all these voices as if they're people. He just talked to these texts as if they're people and told them to persuade Phaedrus. And then it made Phaedrus almost into a text himself, right? Let them persuade Phaedrus. He almost turns Phaedrus into the third person. Makes him an object, a subject, a character, right? And then the only difference being that now he says, let Phaedrus answer. The difference for Socrates between a speaker and a written text is a speaker can presumably answer himself. Written text can't. Of course, remember, we're reading a written text. We're going to come back to that. If everything he says about written texts are in fact true. Right. Okay. Socrates says, well, is it not true then that rhetoric, taken as a whole, is an art of influencing the soul through words, not merely in law courts and all other public meeting places, but in private gatherings also? Is it not the same when concerned with small as with great matters, and to put the matter in the right light, is it to be esteemed no more when involved in important affairs than it is occupied with the trivial? Isn't that what you've heard? Here's Socrates. Socrates is our man here, right? Socrates is speaking our rhetoric, right? It's like it's everywhere, right? That's what's at stake right now. In a way, what he's telling us, right? What this dialogue is telling us is right now he's questioning rhetoric in performing it. The rhetoric is not this thing that's solely left to the courts. It's not this thing that happens in these privileged, exclusive moments, but happens everywhere, including right now as I'm talking to you, Phaedrus. What's at stake in my seduction of you, Phaedrus? And your bozo-ness back to me? What's happening right here, right? In a way, Socrates always folds the exchange into the moment of their interaction, into the moment of the performative moments of the thing happening itself. Not just what it talks about, but what it does and how it acts on us. Right? So here he is shifting the purview of their discussion to include their own presumably trivial moment. Right? It's not a court case, it's just two men hanging out talking. And of course, what does Phaedrus say? No, that isn't what I've heard. What I've heard went something like this. As an art of both speaking and writing, rhetoric is used in law courts, and as an art of speaking in the public assemblies. But I haven't heard of any other uses. And this is a hilarious moment. Then you've heard only of the treatise on rhetoric by Nestor and Odysseus, which they wrote during their leisure hours at Troy. You've never heard of Palamedes? No, I swear I never heard of Nestor's either, unless by Nestor you mean Gorgias, and Odysseus will be Thrasymachus or Theodorus. Socrates says, well, perhaps, never mind. Socrates never knows anything. Right? He's always misquoting. He has this terrible memory. Right? He just makes shit up. Clearly, he's never being serious. He's always sort of putting Phaedrus on. Right? As if he quoted like a, you know, one of these masterful authorial texts, Phaedrus would then be persuaded. So he just makes it up. Right? Phaedrus calls him on. He says, all right, just let it go. What do I care? And then he says, well, perhaps. Let it all pass. Tell me this. In the law courts, what do the litigants do? Don't they speak against each other? Yep. About justice and injustice? Yep. Then the man who speaks with the skill of art can make the same thing appear to the same people just at one time and unjust as another as he chooses. That's the critique of the rhetorician. He can spin it one way or spin it another. It is precisely the grounds that Hollywood has for its disdain of lawyers. Right? All the law movies, these horrible, ridiculous law movies, the lawyer always has begins as an immoral character who doesn't care which side of the case he takes. And then he has some moment of conscience and he gives up the law, right? Or he secretly gets his defendant convicted. Or he does something equally moral and vindictive and self-righteous, right? The fear of the defense attorney is that he has no morals. He can argue both sides. He doesn't care. Does that make sense? Right? The rhetorician isn't tethered to a position. He only goes with the crowd, right? So he can argue both sides. Now let's look at that description again. The man who speaks with the skill of art can make the same thing appear to the same people just at one time and unjust another as he chooses. Right? Let's talk about Socrates. Right? Doesn't Socrates make Phaedrus see one side and then see the other? Doesn't Socrates argue both sides? First he argues both sides about love, then he argues both sides about writing. There's nothing inherently bad about writing, then he says there is something inherently bad about writing. Doesn't Socrates perform exactly this? Doesn't he function a little like a demagogue towards Phaedrus? Right? So here again, Socrates is naming his own actions. Right? He's naming the sophist, condemning the sophist, but he himself has performed precisely those actions. It makes us wonder what is the status of his condemnation. Does that make sense? Do you see how he performs this here? Okay. So what else? And when he speaks in the assembly, he'll make the same thing appear good to the city on one occasion and the reverse on another. All right. And you jump to 49, but line 262. Socrates says, well then, it is in shifting by easy stages from point to point rather than by leaps and bounds that a person is more apt to arrive unwittingly at the direct opposite. Again, it names this very dialogue itself. Right? Here's Socrates moving Phaedrus through all these kinds of little micro steps. Right, sort of harassing him, distracting him. Next thing you know, Phaedrus goes from one side to the other. From the side of the non-lover to the side of the lover. From Lysias to Socrates. From rhetoric to philosophy. Right? So again, this is Socrates naming the very thing he himself is doing. All right, let's skip around a little bit. So they keep talking about this shit. Gets kind of pedantic. I could parse the shit out of it, but I don't feel like it. Socrates, again, remember, on 52, he forgets his memory. You know, he can't remember anything. He's like, oh, yeah, let's talk about that old speech I gave, but I can't remember. Did I define love at the beginning of my speech? He can't remember the whole speech he gave. Right? He has no memory. Obviously, if he has no memory, what is that a symptom of? It's a symptom of writing. Right? Clearly, he's one who, in some sense, writes. Right? If his memory is so bad, that's what he tells us, right? That to write things down is to ruin your memory, because it externalizes your memory, right? So that things that are written make it so that you don't have to remember; they become reminders, so that in fact you don't have to remember. It puts memory outside of yourself.
This seems to be the first instance where the thing he is forgetting is something he's actually speaking. Mm-hmm. But before that, it's always written text. Mm-hmm.
Very good, yes. Very good. Why is that significant?
Well, just because his argument is that it is writing that makes you forget.
Yes.
Writing is
right.
Speak, but somehow that doesn't hold.
Right. Absolutely, right? At his, if you track his losses of memory, they generally are about written texts, but here it's about his own speaking. All right? And of course, that speech, the status of that speech is unclear, right? Because it's still a speech. But you're right, it begins to blur. Right, and unsettle any clear grounds for him not remembering. Right? And we know that he's always a writer, in some sense. Right? In no other way, he hears voices. What is it to hear voices, but to be a reader of texts? Isn't that what it is to hear voices? It's an imprint on you. It's not just coming out of him. It's an imprint on him. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been trying to give you guys a whole, schizo view of the world. This is I mean, not to belittle the disease of schizophrenia, which is very real and is horrible. Really, no, I've been around a fair amount of it. You guys might notice, right? All this stuff comes out in college, right? It comes out early teens. So for some reason in Philadelphia, everybody I knew was strange. I don't know if it has to do with the water in Philly, maybe. So not to poo-poo schizophrenia. So I'm always cautious talking about that, but. I can steal and quote Deleuze and Guattari, my favorite philosophers, who talk about schizoanalysis and multiplying, proliferating the multiplicity of voices. You already are kind of schizo. You want to amplify that, right? And the kind of analysis they perform on text they call schizoanalysis, right? That they try to make the text schizo to itself, which is kind of what I'm trying to show in this text. This text is a little schizo, right? It plays with itself, it undoes itself, there's a multiplicity of voices that speak through it and kind of disseminate or decenter any sort of basis it has. Right? It's a little wacky, it's a little ungrounded. So then it says, okay, let's talk about the speech of Lysias. Read it anyway. I want to hear Lysias himself. They're comparing their two speeches. I want to hear Lysias himself. I want to hear Lysias himself. But where's Lysias? Again, it's this weird slippage between the person and the text, between the body of the person and the body of the text. I want to hear Lysias himself read his speech. I want to hear Lysias himself read his speech. His speech, then, becomes the body of Lysias. And poor Phaedrus has to read it over and over, and it's so bad. And Socrates says, well, you know, we could go through the speech, but it really kind of sucks. Top of 53, he goes, as for myself and my ignorance, I thought the writer boldly set down whatever happened to come into his head. Can you explain his arrangement of the topics and the order he has adopted as a result of some principle of composition? Phaedrus is like, I don't know. Socrates is like, well, but to this you will surely agree. Every discourse, like a living creature, should be so put together that it has its own body and lacks neither head nor feet, middle nor extremities, all composed in such a way that they suit both each other and the whole. You got to ask yourself, as rhetoricians, every time you hear a text talk about what a text should be, you got to ask yourself, what about the text I'm reading? So here's Phaedrus, Socrates, who just described what a discourse should be. Every discourse should be, makes a moral claim, should be a certain way. Is this text that way? Could we describe Plato's Phaedrus as a discourse that has its own head and body, lacks neither head nor feet, middle nor extremities, all composed in such a way they suit both each other and the whole? What do you think? Right? It's a very strange dialogue, this thing, right? It doesn't seem rigorously structured. It begins with a happenstance meeting. A happenstance meeting of Phaedrus and Socrates on the street. Right? Then they're talking about love, right? And then they're talking about language and rhetoric. And the whole thing does speak part to whole, but I'm not sure I see a beginning and an end. I just see a whole lot of middle, right? The text is constantly performing irony, right? It's constantly, every moment in this text is ironic, and that if that's the point of the text, right? If it's an argument for irony, right? Irony is happening all the time in every exchange. Well, then the text has always already begun, and it's always already happening everywhere in the text. It doesn't have a clear beginning, middle, end. It doesn't have a clear narrative arc. Does that make sense? Now, of course, it does have a clear narrative arc. Just to complicate things for you. In some sense, we'll see Phaedrus, right, go from Lysias's lover, to become Socrates' lover. Socrates effectively seduces this kid, right? Or from rhetoric. Philosophy, right? In some sense, the dialogue does have this kind of very clear narrative path. It's a nice story, right? It's a straight out of Hollywood, right? The character has his narrative arc. He has his turn. He sees the light, right? just like every piece of shit movie made on the planet out of that horrible machine of Hollywood. Everyone has to have their moment and transform and become good. He starts being young and immature. He stands, ends mature. See? Ends mature. But of course, that is not the narrative of the dialogue. Right? It is one moment. It is one trajectory within this dialogue. There is another. Right? And that is Socrates. It's actually a third. Right? There's Socrates, who doesn't go through any changes. He's always the same. But his sameness is one of constantly being ironic, of constantly being two positions. So his sameness, his one position, is a position that is itself two positions. Does that make sense? And it's always the same, right? It's like a steady hum. Right? So there's no beginning, middle, and end. It's always the same. His argument begins, he's ironic right in that first page, right? When he says, oh, you know, as Pindar says, this is the most important thing. As Pindar puts it, a matter of loftier import than even the most instant task. You and me, Phaedrus, we must go and talk. Right? He's not serious there. He's not kidding. He's not serious. He's not kidding. He's not serious. He's both serious and not serious. He's ironic. Right? The text makes an argument for irony. That means this text is always happening. We got the argument right on page one. It didn't lead up to it. It didn't give its argument. It didn't give a nice reasoned way for it. It just does it. It performs it all the time. Right? So in that sense, the text is in a way a monotone, but it's a monotone that is itself a chorus because it always speaks in two voices. Right? So it speaks in this one tone, but this one tone is the tone of irony, which is in fact two voices. Okay. I like how complicated this gets. There's another moment here, right? You all with me? Are you with me? Okay. As long as you're with me. I get worried if you're not. That's why I look at you. What's the third narrative? Come on, rhetoricians. What's the third narrative? Draw for me the outline of a rhetorical event. What are the main characters in any rhetorical exchange? Thank you, Miss Frank. Right? The reader. The reader is transformed, right? So you have the text that's in the text, which includes both these trajectories. But then we have the reader's transformation. And the reader's transformation is very strange, right? Because the reader's transformation may very well be one of an arc in which you go from not irony to irony. But that's strange because that's not a narrative arc, because then you're seduced in this way to this position, not to this position. So in a way, you do have an arc of the reader. No one can see this, but I'll write it anyway. Right? From seriousness to irony. But in a way, your arc is both an arc and a straight line. Does that make some sense? Remember what Bart says. Bart says the text, the reader becomes a kind of paper that the text writes on, writes directly onto you. Right? You become the receiver of everything that text offers, all of its multiplicity. Even if a particular character can't see anything, even if an author can't see everything, the body of the reader becomes inscribed with everything in the text. So here you see, you have these two trajectories of the text, an arc and this kind of straight, weird line, ironic line. But they imprint themselves on you, the reader. So you go through a narrative arc, but your narrative arc isn't the same as Phaedrus's. You don't go from sophistry to rhetoric. You go from the univocal to the ironic, right? But the problem is irony itself can't have a narrative arc. I don't know why I'm making it so complicated, because I like it. So this narrative arc is effaced the minute you actually are done, right? It's almost the same as, it is a similar logic to when we talked about Nietzsche. When Nietzsche reverses the relationship between science and art and says art comes first, something very strange happens, right? Because now, right, because art doesn't actually ascribe to hierarchy. So the very possibility of one thing over the other can't happen, right? The very conditions of making art king means that there's no king. Right? Science can have a king, right? So science can be the king of art, but if you reverse the terms and you say art's king, well, then it becomes king and commits suicide in the same breath, because art would never say it's king. It doesn't believe in kingdom. Right? And so the very terms of the reversal efface the very possibility of a reversal. Right? It inaugurates a new world. Right? And so it's the same kind of thing here, where you go through a narrative arc, but your transformation into an ironic being effaces the narrative arc. And you become just an ironic being. Yeah.
To try to restate that,
Yes. Yes, yeah, I mean, that's a much clearer way to put it. Yes. Yes.
It's a storyline, but it actually a storyline that has no possibility to progress because it's there from the beginning.
Exactly. Exactly. Did you all hear, John? You begin, it's all serious, you put it much clearer than I did. You begin serious, you realize by the end that it's ironic and that irony was always at play, right? So you've always read it twice in a way, which speaks to irony, which is dialogical. Two logics, two words. Right? I forgot water, so I'm kind of choking to death up here. See, you screwed me up. No, you didn't. Two logics, two words, right? The text has these two logics, right? The logic of always speaking twice. In a way, you've always read the text twice, right? You read it once straight, you read it once ironically. And once you get to the end, once you get to that great moment where he says, don't take anything written seriously, it's like the text left off the page, left off of your hands and punched you in the face and said, listen, this thing's ironic. It has to be. It just told you it is. Right. So let's keep going. We'll get to another one of my favorite moments here. All right, so they're all talking about this misconstrued discourse. Again, Phaedrus of Socrates, you're making fun of our speech. Of course he is. He's constantly making fun of him. Phaedrus can't deal with it. So Phaedrus says, Socrates says, well, the despair of your feelings will pass it over. Yet there were a good many things in it which seemed to be profitable examples to consider, though hardly to imitate. Let us proceed, however, to other speeches. It seems to me that there was something in them that those who want to study rhetoric might find worth examining. What sort of thing do you mean? Top of 54. It says, the two speeches were, in a sense, direct opposites. One advocated favoring the lover, the other the non-lover. And Phaedrus says, and right manfully too. It's a crass double entendre, right? I mean, it's a crass pun. I don't even quite know the double entendre. It's just pornographic, right? And right manfully too. And then Socrates, this is another great moment. Socrates says, I thought you were going to say madly, which would be the truth. This, in fact, is exactly what I had in mind. After all, we said that love was a kind of madness, didn't we? What just happened here? They're having this dialogue. Right? And at the end, remember, Socrates is going to say, true dialectic, true philosophy is between two people, two jovial, congenial, smart people exchanging ideas back and forth. Right? So here Phaedrus says, yeah, you did that quite manfully. And Socrates goes, well, I thought you were going to say madly, which is right. Okay? Meaning there's a weird slip here of logic. They're not actually going back and forth. So like Socrates now stuffing words in Phaedrus' mouth. He's not actually following a logic of a clear movement, right, back and forth between them. It's a conscious slip. He thought he was going to say madly, so we'll talk about that, right? It's this incredibly sort of odd, unreasonable moment. Right? Are you with me there? It's a hilarious moment. It's not this like reason back and forth. You always picture Socrates very reasonable in his arguments. He's a good listener. He really must listen to his other people, right? Because he says, you know, what's nice about the spoken word is the person's right there, present to me. So Phaedrus says, yes, manfully. And Socrates goes, oh, I thought you were going to say madly. Let's just talk about madly. He's not listening at all to Phaedrus. Right? Dialogue just slips. It just jumps over this. Right? But what's even stranger is the particular slip that takes place here. Right? The slip that takes place is from the manful to the mad. Right? From the mortal to the divine. Right? It's precisely the slip that this text makes. And what's beautiful about this seemingly innocuous moment, this seemingly unimportant moment, is again, it tells us the strange configuration of rhetoric, of irony. Because what's strange about irony is that it holds two positions together that can't be reconciled, mortality and divinity, right? Temporality and eternity. These two things cannot be held together, yet they are, right? So there's a necessary gap between them. They'll never combine. They'll never. It's like oil and water. They'll never combine. They'll stay separate. They can't be mixed together. Right? There's a necessary division between them. Just as the slip from manfully to madly can't be explained. It's just a slip. It just happens. There's no logical reason for it. Right? It's just a jump. Manful? No, mad. Right? And it's again, Phaedrus attempts to go the path of the manful. Socrates takes in the path of the mad, but what matters is the movement from the manful to the mad. Does that make some sense? You have no idea what I'm talking about, do you? All right, so picture it this way. Phaedrus, remember in our little dichotomy, I hate to get rid of my nice diagram because this explained everything. Right? We had, over here we have man, over here we have God. Over here we have rhetoric. Over here we have philosophy, right? Right, over here we have words. Over here we have truth. Right, lust, love, right? Is this fair?
So what you're saying is it's just the performative of the ironic.
Yes, right, very good, right? So Phaedrus says, how manful. That's this path, right? Right, what we also get over here is rationality. This is the other key move, right? Rationality, madness. Right? Remember that the reason Lysias argues that you should dig the non-lover is because it's rational. Argues against madness, right? And Socrates, in his second speech, privileges madness as divine. Okay? Here, I'll put this up top. Rationality. Mad. Okay? At this moment in the dialogue, this seemingly innocuous moment, I argue that you see irony again performed. And it becomes, again, like this performative pedagogy where it explains itself to you. Right? Phaedrus says, how manful. Socrates says, well, I thought you were going to say mad. Right? So we get the one side of the dichotomy, the other side of the dichotomy. But what matters, what this text performs, is the slip between them. This is the text, Phaedrus. Right? In some sense, if this represents Phaedrus, this represents Socrates, the third voice here is Plato, which is the text itself. That happens in the in-between, the movement between these things. That's what this text is. It is the space of the dialogic. The dialogic, which is irony. And we can call that Plato, if you like. Right? So that one little moment, you see one path, you see the other path, and you see the movement between them. It's inexplicable, yet happens. It's impossible, but actual. One of my favorite phrases. You know where I get impossible but actual from? Of all people, Catherine McKinnon. Isn't that weird? Isn't that surprising? Someone once asked Catherine McKinnon. Catherine McKinnon is an ardent, she's a legal theorist who argues passionately for the banning of pornography along the lines, using John Austen, using the performative. She argues that pornography is the rape of women. Don't just portray it, it is it. Right? And so she helped Canada draft its anti-pornography laws. And she argues that in our culture, women are structurally, performatively, always subjugated and raped. That basically all heterosexual sex is rape. Now, she's married to a man with kids and has a very esteemed power of position, position of power. And so she was asked once, you know, how do you reconcile your theory, which says this is impossible, with your stature? And she says, well, it's impossible but actual. It's such a great phrase. So I stole it from her. And, last time I'll talk about Catherine McKinnon, I promise. But you might, it's something you might be interested in, right? She has a book called Only Words, right? In which she argues, uses explicitly John Austen, the argument of the performative, to argue against, or in favor of banning pornography. And it is actually a discussion I usually have in this class, but I think we're going to run out of time in this semester. Okay. Possible but actual. That's what this slip is. That's what irony is. It's impossible but actual. Why is it actual? Because it's lived through, right? It's through the movement of life happening that you can hold together two radically disparate things, right? They can't occupy the same position. So if you're static, you can't be both mortal and divine because they can't occupy the same position. But if you move, you can. Irony is always a movement. One way to think about that is irony only exists in its performance. Does that make sense? Right? Irony itself is always itself something that moves because it can't be constitutively ironic. Irony is the relationship between the constitutive and the performative, between what's said and how it's said. It necessarily takes up motion, necessarily takes up life itself. You have any idea what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Augustus is with me. It's me and Augustus to the Promised Land. That's okay. I feel safe. I feel like we'll be okay together. We'll take care of things.
So it's impossible by the measure of our own rationality. That's why it's impossible.
Mm. Exactly. Very good. Yes. Right? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't... Very good. Rationally makes no sense. There's no philosophical position. There's no logical position I can give you that will reconcile these two positions. Absolutely. But more importantly, it has to be through a movement between these things. Right? It's precisely through movement. That what irony teaches us, amongst other things, is to read performatively. Because irony has to be performed. There's no such thing as a static claim that's ironic. Because then it would just be a claim. Irony is, I said this thing, and and there's another movement to it. There's always a double movement to irony. Does that make sense? I need you to think about that. Why irony, in what ways irony is necessarily invokes the performative. It is necessarily a performative. Right? It is distinctly the relationship between what one says and how one says it. Between what one says and the mere fact that it was said. Right? Right. Let's keep going. Although I really like that moment. So they talk about a lot of, you know, silly things. Phaedrus, I have in my notes here, Phaedrus, he's a moron. There's some complicated stuff here about division. I kind of want to skip over. Jesus Christ, this is so complicated in here. Okay, there's a good moment here, though. I'm 56. Right, they're talking about all these different arguments about how to conduct a speech. What they're really talking, they keep talking about are these sophistic texts, right? And what Socrates is going to critique in these sophistic texts is the notion of a rule of the right thing in a circumstance, right? And we'll get to that. Because he's going to say, how can you read a book and study in a classroom the way to speak to people? It doesn't make any sense. Because to speak to people, it's human, it's alive, it's temporal. Right? It's what I told you is the very premise of what makes rhetoric an odd discipline, what's such an odd art, that I can't just give you a rule. Right? I can't tell the politician, always use good diction. Always, you know, speak about abortion. Well, no. Sometimes you got to change how you speak to win over the crowd. And you won't know until you're there. Right? So it's always circumstantial. So the very possibility of rules in rhetoric is very complicated and basically impossible. And so Socrates is going through these critiques of these sophistic texts that seem to proffer rules. Okay? And so they're talking about this one, and at the bottom, Phaedrus says, well, do you mean the worthy Theodorus? And I love Socrates. Well, what if I do? I don't know why. He's so funny, right? He's never just serious with them. He says, there's also the way to manage refutation and supplementary refutation for both prosecution and defense. Shall we not bring the illustrious Evenus of Paris before us? He was the inventor of covert allusion and indirect praise. Some say that he also wrote indirect censure. What does that sound like again? Isn't that irony? Isn't that Socrates? Right? Covert allusion and indirect praise. When Socrates is just bashing rhetoric, does he really mean it? Or is it? Yeah.
And also, just like the whole entire text, you mentioned earlier how it takes place outside the city. But yet, at the same time, it's almost like the city sort of, it's almost like he never really leaves the city because he has to be with him. So, I mean, it's kind of cool. You know, I don't like going outside the city walls too much either because I get very red. But it's kind of cool now. It's kind of comforting to know that it can be ironic.
What's going on here? Sunscreen. I don't know what's happening here. It's comforting you go outside the city and bring a book with you, yes. Sometimes you just try going without a book. It's good for you, yeah.
Socrates, I guess that's the Socratic irony we're talking about. He always speaks in that middle voice, that ambivalent voice. He always finds the middle ground where he's neither this nor that. He's neither a rhetorician nor a philosopher. It's right there in the middle of what you're talking about. And that's what he maintains, and that's he weaves his own truth. Picks and chooses, and
yes. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Very good. Right. I like. We talked a lot about the middle voice, neither active nor passive, happening in this place in between. Right. The one qualification I would say is that he's neither this nor that, and he's both this and that. Right. Which is logically, just for the just the fuck you to Aristotelian logic, right? Aristotelian logic says the base. We don't ever know the basic premise of Aristotelian logic. I know nothing. I never took a logic class, so I might be making this up. But yeah, no, even before that, it's a logic of non-contradiction, right? So A cannot equal not A, right? That's just the basic thing. So a thing is itself. It can't be its own opposite. But of course, for Socrates, it always is, right? There's always a movement, right? The Socrates is both, right? I mean, this is the logic of either or, right? It's either one or the other. Can't be both. What's nice about Socrates is that he's both God and man, right? And neither God nor man, right? It's holding these opposing things together under the same place, in the same position. Right?
I'm having trouble placing Nietzschean rhetoric and Socratic rhetoric. They're just sort of like meshing into each other.
Right. Although, there's two, they got very close together and they're very far apart. Right? So Nietzsche is really interested in this relentless play. Right, in a kind of trickery, a kind of impishness, a kind of endless proliferation, a will to create, to create, to create, to create, to create. Right, with a total indifference for divinity, a total indifference for anything that's not here. Just play, just play, just play. This life, affirm this life, all the multiplicity of this life. This life teems with its own possibilities. This life proliferates itself with everything that happens in every sensual interaction. There, you are inundated with a play. Right, right. So, for Socrates, it's always irony. He only has one trope. Right? Here, that might be the clearest way to put it. That Nietzsche says, what then is the truth? It says it's a mobile army of metaphors, metonymies, synecdoches, right? It's all the possible tropes. For Socrates, there's only one trope. It's irony. He's always dialogic. He's always got a logic of the two. I say something and I don't mean it. He never just indulges pure multiple play. He never just folds things together any which way and comes up with something nutty. Right? Talked about David Letterman versus Conan O'Brien, right? He said David Letterman is an ironist, right? He always has the same shtick. It's always this kind of, and that's why he can constantly just be repeating the same shtick, and it has this kind of reverence. He kind of undoes. It's why, and it's sort of broken down in the old days. Celebrities were really scared to go on a show because he has no patience for these pompous claims to celebrity. He doesn't think it buys you anything. Right? He still wants to see you live. He still wants to see you act. He'd make very famous celebrities very uncomfortable. And they have to stop that for various financial reasons. But Conan O'Brien will just make weird jokes, like the pimp robot. It's not ironic. He just folds different shit together. It's just pure play. What's weird together? Let's just jam stuff together. Does that make sense? As two different modes? Right? Nietzsche, the tradition that comes out of Nietzsche is the tradition of the surrealists, right? The Dadaists, right? The situationists, the pranksters. Right, the people just jam a whole bunch of shit together. The cut-up, William Burroughs' cut-up. Right? You can picture Socrates reading Burroughs' cut-up. Right? Or you know, looking at surrealist painting, be like, what the hell? Right? Socrates has a reverence for truth that Nietzsche just never even entertains for a moment. Does that make some sense? But you're in the right place. Of like, they do come close together in these weird moments and then are miles apart, infinitely far. And it's, again, the reason why Nietzsche spends a lot of time talking about Socrates, for this reason. Right? So, again, here's another weird moment where Socrates himself is the inventor of covert illusion, and his covert illusion is the illusion he's making when he says it. Do you understand that? Here he is bringing up Evenus of Paros, the inventor of covert illusion, right? And indirect praise. But Socrates himself is constantly making indirect praise, right? And the opposite, right? Indirect censure. So he sounds like he's critiquing one thing when he really isn't. He sounds like he's critiquing rhetoric, but he's not really. It sounds like he's praising love, but not really. He's always acting indirectly. Right? And here he himself makes a covert illusion. You know what his covert illusion is? His covert illusion is the covert illusion. Right? He's always naming himself in these kind of odd moments. Right? These are seemingly indifferent or addendums, these ornamental moments of the text, the story of the crickets, this slip of the tongue, this covert illusion. Always fold back in, right? All the moments that seem like they don't fit in the dialogue, I'm actually trying to argue, are the moments that most define it, the most conspicuous moments of it. All right, we're almost done here, don't worry. All right, so jump, you can see on 58. I really would love to finish this today. Let's say I'm 58. Right, so now I told you they're critiquing this notion of rhetoric that is codified, or rule-based, precisely because it can't hold up. Right? So Socrates says, about middle of the text, he goes, tell me now, suppose someone were to go to your friend Eric Zamicus or his father Acumenus and say to them, I know how to apply such and such to bodies so as to induce a fever, or if I wish to lower temperature. If the fancy takes me, I can make them vomit, or again, move their bowels, and so forth and so on. Since I have this knowledge, I claim that I am a physician and can make the same of any other man to whom I communicate this knowledge. What do you think they would reply? And Phaedrus says, well, surely they would ask if the fellow also knew who it was that ought to be treated and the proper occasion for each treatment and how far it should proceed. Okay? So here he's saying, you know, what's weird about rhetoric is he is critiquing these schools of sophistry, but the grounds on which he's critiquing them is that they might teach you the skill of speaking well, but they don't teach you anything about the occasion, and it's precisely the occasion that is the subject of rhetoric. How do you know what to say at the right time in that particular occasion? Right? So his critique of rhetoric here really needs to be qualified, right? So it's a critique of rules. Right? And again, his critique of the sophists and their rules is identical to his critique of ardent moralists. Right? They commit the same sin to him, which is the sin of thinking you know. Thinking you can make rules of things, right? His life, this philosophy is a philosophy of movement, of dialogic, of constantly effacing what you say, of never taking something serious, right? And so anyone who comes along and thinks they know, whether they're a religious zealot, right, or a confirmed bachelor seducer rhetorician, both those people are wrong for the same reason, that they think they know. So his critique of rhetoric is actually not any different than his critique, in fact, of the religious. Does that make sense? Right? It's a critique of the code that he critiques. Yeah. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Or to be a tyrant, right? You're either going to be screwed or you're going to be a tyrant, right? All right, we won't get to the very end. We'll get to the very end on Tuesday. Mike, any sense? You have no freaking idea what I'm talking about. A little bit of both. Okay, watch. I'm going to hand out your final. Okay. I never know how to do this. No, side to side. Huh? I don't know. Do you know how to do this? I'm terrible at this. I don't think so. I think I got it under control. Oh, you know what, though? I'm going to turn this off for one moment so I don't say anything weird to these. All right, hold on one sec, everybody, okay? Hey. So what I'm hoping is, look over these questions, okay? Now, over the weekend. And what I'm hoping is you'll see the arguments I'm making here. And I'm hoping these will actually be prompts. They will prompt you to have a little bit of understanding. We'll finish up on Tuesday. But what I need you guys to do is, if you're anxious or you don't know what the hell I'm talking about, you don't know what you're going to say, have questions. That's what I'm here for. I'm theoretically the teacher. Okay, that's all. Go away.